He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, whakaronga mai ki te ao tai whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. G'day. Today we're in Coromandel, where we meet a man who's a mine of information about the area's once thriving granite industry.
We take our usual spin around the country to hear about conditions on the land. We hear Southland farmers are thrilled with the autumn they've been dished up.
And later, Cosmo meets an entrepreneur in Golden Bay who has New Zealand's only plantation of a Mexican plant used for making tequila.
But first, to kick the show off this week, Susan Murray caught up with a farmer to talk about the pesky possum and how he gets rid of them without poison using auto-kill traps.
Hi, my name is Ben Stubbs. I'm farming up in the King Country in Waitomore. We're farming a piece of land, about 1,600 acres, with a large area of native forest on it.
And the native forest, you are doing possum trapping in it?
Yeah, well, we are. Recently, we got some money through the Gordon Stevenson Fund and managed to get some auto traps, some AT220s. I think we managed to get about 25 of those. And since Christmas, they've killed about, we're over 800 now. So it looks really good for us.
Were you surprised at how many you caught in that time?
Well, not in a sense. I've done a lot of possuming in the past, and I know that there are big numbers of possums out there if you are able to, you know, get a trap that actually works for you and works systematically around a property.
And what's that meant? So 800 possums, that's quite a bit of fur.
Yeah, a huge amount of fur. We've sold the first lot just recently and made $4,000, which equated to more than my wool check this summer. So you know, it stacks up pretty well as long as it can work in with your day, your day's work routine, which it does for us. I managed to set up a system where as I go around the farm, I'm picking up the possums on the way around, so I can work it in with moving cattle and moving sheep around.
And when you say $4,000 from the fur, more than you'd get for the wool, how many sheep are you shearing in the year?
This summer, I think we must have shorn close on a couple of thousand, I guess.
The wool from 2,000 sheep is not worth as much as the fur from 800 possums.
Correct, yep.
That is mind-blowing.
Yeah, it makes you look differently at a possum that's been run over on the road. Yeah.
You're stopping to pick them up.
Yeah, well, if it was a $5 note on the road, I think you'd stop. Yeah, one of the things that I have got, I've got a plucking machine, so a petrol-powered plucker. That makes it possible to pluck them once they've been dead for a little bit. You know, a lot of the guys that trap with, like the conventional foot traps, they're able to pluck them immediately. You know, obviously with one of these kill traps, the fur actually sets, so it's got to be pulled out a little bit more vigorously, perhaps.
What, yeah, about all the carcasses?
Well, yeah, I chop the heads and feet off them and feed them to the dogs, so that's another big saving for us on the farm. We've got, I think, 5 dogs at the moment, and they're effectively being overfed. So that's always a good thing too.
If you have killed 800 possums just in that time, how likely do you think as a country we are going to be to reach this pest-free status by 2050?
Oh, I think with sensible management, and obviously that comes from looking after the land really well, you know, and having that as part of a routine on farms, I think we'd stand a reasonable chance, provided we get, you know, help. We need help in the way of encouragement, I guess, from communities, and perhaps having people, you know, that are able to come on perhaps and help with the last few animals is the thing. You know, like I'm killing possums, but I would imagine that there's still, you know, maybe 10% left, something like this. that they'll still be able to breed.
You'll keep on with the traps though in that area?
I'm pondering whether I work the whole rotation for a start, and then maybe set them around the farm in the key sort of hot spots, I guess, and then follow up with a program of poisoning as well, which would be another option for me. Poisoning, the thing with poisoning is that with a lot of farms, there's other issues with laying poisons on farms. So I'm sort of very happy with these auto traps because we don't have that issue at all. It's nice to have a report something that is a success story, I guess, with the odd possums because, it's a real challenge, that's for sure, for a lot of farms. Yeah, and I think the other thing that's really important to realise is the more land that is retired on farms, this is creating a haven, obviously, for the species that we want to preserve, but it's also creating a nesting site and a larder for all of the predators. So that's something that's going to become an issue in the future, I would say.
And now to our look at conditions on the land. Northland still needs a decent dose of rain. The countryside's green dry. A stock agent says recent wean affairs went better than expected, but now it's hard to match buyers with sellers. There's just not enough feed to give buyers confidence. In the Pukekohe district, at last, dry, brown grass is giving way to green. Thanks to substantial rain last weekend, mainly fine mild weather this week with the odd shower. Brassicas have sized up and are looking good. For most crops, irrigation equipment has been given a rest. Moist soil has responded well to cultivation as growers prepare fields to sow onions.
Waikato around Pairoa is looking very good. There's been a bit of rain which has helped fertilisers soak in. More rain's expected over the weekend and next week. The farmer we called is moving to another farm on the 1st of June and is really pleased to be able to leave the farm he's on with good pasture covers. He says his cows are milking phenomenally well. They're producing 20% more each day than they were at the same time last year. He says he'll definitely be milking right through to the end of the season with all of the cows. Rain before Easter in Bay of Plenty has really kicked growth along on farms. It's still very mild and facial eczema spore counts are higher than farmers would like. There are huge signs on roadsides advertising work in the kiwi fruit industry. The gold harvest is underway.
There was a fog in King Country on Friday morning. The regions responded well to last week's rain. With winter approaching, farmers are dropping stock numbers. Weaner cattle are being sold and store lambs are heading out of the area to Hawke's Bay and Wairarapa. Lots of hunters have been passing through Tomaranui as they head out for the roar. The New Zealand Shearing Championships are underway in Te Kuiti. They're an even bigger deal this year than usual, as last year's event was cancelled because of the lockdown, and this year's Golden Shears didn't go ahead either. Our contact in Taranaki is on track for record farm production. This time last year he had dried off his herd. Now he's milking close to peak numbers, and the cows still have plenty of feed ahead of them. He says the last of the maize crops have come off and newly sown grass around the district is looking good.
It was a stunning day on Friday in Gisborne. The big vegetable grower Liederbrand has almost finished constructing a dam to collect water off the roof of the huge indoor growing facility that it's about to build. It'll cover 15 hectares in all. The equipment to build the structure is on the water, 50 to 60 containers worth, and site prep is planned for before winter rains come. A new cool store for Liederbrand's vegetables is also being built, and the old one demolished. It's 40 years old and was energy inefficient and difficult to wash down and keep clean. So a more environmentally friendly building with modern refrigeration is in the pipeline. A Hawke's Bay farmer told us he was out trying to find some green grass when we called. He says another 30 millimetres of rain would make a huge difference. The pasture's greened up a bit but just hasn't kicked ahead, although he admits it's still a lot better than it was this time last year. He's got rid of his cull cows but still has 17,000 lambs to feed. He's been busy this week sorting sheep for the local dog trials. 900 were required. Trucks filled with grapes have stopped rumbling from the vineyards around him to wineries.
Wairarapa was blasted with nor'west winds on Sunday and Monday. The sun has come out after good rain last week. People are trying to get grass seed in the ground in time for rain in the forecast. The rams have all gone out with the ewes, which are in good condition, but there's a lot of grass staggers about. It's caused by fungal toxins in usually older pasture and affects the ewe's coordination and her ability to stand up. It can be brought on by stress, so one way farmers try to manage it is to move animals very quietly. They're also feeding out barley and grain where they can, but that's difficult in the hill country. Grass staggers can impede ovulation and reduce pregnancy rates. Manawatū has had nice autumn weather and enough rain for moisture levels to be okay. A fertiliser rep has reported the size of the orders from dairy farmers is much larger than they've been for a number of years. With a good payout, there's a bit more money washing about and people are putting it back into the land. There's a bit of chat that vegetable growers are struggling to sell a green vegetable at the moment. There are no cruise ships coming in or other international tourists, so with fewer mouths, they need to adjust how much they plant. Prices to growers are very poor right now.
Across the strait to Te Waipounamu now, and it's been a fine week in the Tasman region, although a little cloudy by Friday, and showers or rain are expected over the weekend, which would be good. They've had reasonably consistent rain here, and for pastoral farmers that's been nice. Properties are well set up for autumn, although there are some southern parts that are a little drier. Calf sales are underway, and considering the beef market is down a bit on the highs of the past couple of years, prices have been okay. The prices are back, but our contact says it's not a disaster. Marlborough's weather has been variable. North of the region has recently had about 100 millimetres, but it's extremely concerning that the East Coast, Seddon and Ward areas have missed rain again, and the countryside has now gone from brown to grey. They've been feeding out for 2 months, which is all their winter feed nearly gone, and winter hasn't arrived yet. The local feds have written to the Ministry for Primary Industries asking for government support. They realise this is only a small area, but for the farmers here who've coped with earthquakes and two successive droughts, they're reaching the end of their tether. Mental health is a real concern, and tax relief for those needing to sell capital stock is also needed.
The farmer we called on the West Coast was sounding a little puffed, and he said it was because people have discovered the joy of living on the West Coast. And they're needing sections, so he was busy clearing one for sale. On the farm side, autumn has been a boomer for him. About 150 millimetres is forecast to arrive this weekend, so people are rushing to get summer crop paddocks in and regrassing done before it gets too tricky getting onto paddocks. The temperatures will drop soon, and the window of planting is then missed. Milk production is dropping daily as the tail end of the season is in sight. Around mid-Canterbury, conditions on the land are looking great. The pasture cover on the grass being locked up for winter feed is looking perfect, and the fodder beet, which the dairy cows will be on over the winter, is coming along nicely. Some farmers are already counting down the milking to dry-off day. Our contact in the area says an accident with his dog this week has caused a costly vet bill to land in the mailbox. Meanwhile, 20 minutes drive away in South Canterbury, things aren't so good. The region looks like it should in mid-January. It's very dry. Farmers in the area fear if a decent amount of rain doesn't arrive soon, it'll be a long slog into winter. Heavy winds over the Easter weekend brought down some trees that were planted after World War I. A local farmer says they've never seen winds like it before.
Central Otago is getting a little burnt. There's been no rain since January, pretty much. Winter brassica crops are really struggling. Even ones under irrigation aren't looking good. At least 20 millimetres is needed to improve the situation. As a result, apparently farmers are getting titchy. Calf sales are struggling to get decent prices. The top lines are going okay, but the second cut, lighter calves, aren't moving. Thankfully, the lamb schedule's still holding up. The magnificent autumn colours are starting to reveal themselves once again. And if you could dial up an autumn, Southland farmers would be dialing this one up every year. Conditions are generally really good. The odd spot is a little dry, but no one's complaining. There's plenty of grass, lambs are going well, the rams are out and ewes are in good nick. A complete contrast to last season when farmers were battling to find feed.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
When Carol was on holiday in the northern Coromandel after Christmas, she asked a local who would make a good story for Country Life. She was told Lindsay Garmson, who lives at Paratu Bay on the way to Port Jackson, was a mine of information about Coromandel's once thriving granite industry. So she bumped her way to Lindsay's place, along the gravel road that hugs the coast, over lots of one-way bridges, through a couple of fords, and past a wharf made of enormous granite slabs.
The only granite in New Zealand comes from here. Down the west coast of the South Island, this pure granite, and this stuff is called tunnelite, which has got a lot more quartz in it. The trouble with pure granite is it crumbles after as it gets older. The tunnelite doesn't. It'll last forever. I wrote a book on the granite through my curiosity over, it took about 40 years plus to write it.
So it's all about the
granite,
production
the whole history of the granite. There's about 2,500 pages, and it had to be condensed down to 200 odd. The book's stories never been seen out of Coromandel, really. The butcher sold most of the books in Coromandel. How's that?
Coromandel granite has been used for the construction of some of our most well-known buildings, Parliament House, Auckland's Museum and Ferry Buildings, and the Chief Post Office in Wellington.
The National War Memorial, Auckland Zoo, One Tree Hill, yep. Auckland Savings Bank and Napier. After the earthquake, the government put a lot of money into to keep the place going, keep work going. War memorials and monuments all throughout New Zealand. The further south you go, the less there are. Robert Burns, Timaru, New Zealand House in London, it's all over the place. It's everywhere.
And there are lots of headstones made of it.
Oh, just every cemetery you go into, it's just full of granite. Massive. It's shiny, it's got that lovely, you know, sparkle to it when it's polished.
Granite was noted here at Paratu in 1859 by an Austrian geologist who had been asked to travel around the North Island and report back on mineral deposits. But it wasn't until 38 years later that another geologist, the director of the School of Mines in Thames, ran tests on the granite and presented a report to the Royal Society of New Zealand. Two businessmen spotted an opportunity.
Thomas William Rhodes, who was a newspaper agent, and Robert Crispin Hooper, who was a stonemason from Auckland that came down and lived in Coromandel and set up there, and then they got together. Rhodes did all the money work and all the finding the contracts and that, and Hooper, he worked here and employed one or two people, and they got all the rights to put tracks and railway lines up the creek and that. But a lot of the granite came off the beaches at that time. At that time, there was no such thing as a quarry as such. It was just big rocks cut up. That's why you can see if your tide was out, you see all the cut up rocks everywhere. Yeah, and what's left over.
The granite was cut by hand. First, the workers would drill a line of holes.
And they had feather and wedge, and they put these feathers and wedges all the way around and just tap them and keep going around and tapping them until the rocks split.
It didn't chip off, it came off.
In great big slabs as they wanted it. But there was a real art to it, you know, you had to find a seam. They were real, like old Englishmen, most of them, and Kiwis that had been well trained and had a knack for it.
Do you know how much granite has come out of the quarry or out of this area?
Because it's millions and millions of tons, and there's still millions and millions of tons left in there.
But the last time I understand it was used was when it was reopened. Did Parliament House need
refurbishment? And when they came back for the refurbishment job for the government buildings, Parliament House, they brought up diggers and all the fancy gear, all these machines that could, you know, it could drill the holes, and they were drilling the holes right through the machine here. It had an air compressor in it, so they were drilling down, and the compressor was meant to open the rock up, and they found it was splintering the rock. And so they had to go back to the old way. And when they finished with the diggers, part of the deal was they filled it all in again, and now it's just back to grass and farmland. So underneath the ground in here is absolutely zillions of tons of granite. If you had the right machinery and permission from the greenies... Don't hurt the tadpoles or something. Yes, yeah, there's massive, massive rocks exposed up in the bush. You can just see them as huge faces of granite, just worn over millions of years.
Lindsay says the seam of granite runs for a couple of kilometres along the coast and about a K inland. It was 1993 when the quarry reopened for the work needed on Parliament House and quickly closed again. When granite was first cut in 1900, there were no roads up the coast. Three granite wharves were built so the stone could be shipped by scows to Auckland, 58 kilometres across the Hauraki Gulf.
Over here is where it all started, just right here. This is the quiet little stream, and this just granite. It was just huge, huge boulders. Yeah, it's beautiful. Look at that.
It's got that sparkle.
Yeah. There's one of the hand winches they used to drag the stuff off the beach with, just there.
Did they ever chip it? Was it ever used to make the roads at all?
Yes, they did. Actually, they had a crusher in the early days. It was massive. It was in Auckland. So any offcuts and that went into the crusher. It was taken down places like Gisborne and that ordered a lot of it when they were opening, the councils were opening the roads and things.
Why did they leave? Why did it all wind up in the end?
It was too costly to take away, to take out. You know, it was, the building industry was being replaced with cheaper materials.
And what year did you say it finished here?
Oh, in the 80s.
Up until the 1980s?
Yeah. But it also changed, of course, because the boats didn't come in. They took it out by truck. The roads opened, and the roads opening changed all sorts of things. There is no shipping industry anymore, is there, in the Gulf? This is like the original shed.
What happened in here?
The granite was polished. The railway line's just here, still here, there. And they cut it. In earlier days, they didn't. This was probably after 1917, I'd say. In earlier days, the granite just went out and hung, you know, squarish blocks as best they could get. It just went on the scows, and it was all done in Auckland, cleaned up and squared up and cut for buildings and bases and monuments, of course. Yeah, so they cut it and polished it. It's quite an industry.
Fittingly, for a man who has spent 40 years researching the history of Paratū granite, Lindsay lives in a granite home built on the seaward side of the original quarry site. The sea almost laps under his deck. A small granite wharf is a stone's throw from the front door, and from his lounge he can watch whales scratching themselves on exposed boulders. Locals know the building as the Old Stone Jug.
It was the living quarters and the office for the manager, the owner actually, when he came over from Auckland.
What's it like living in a stone house? Is it cold in winter?
Oh no, it's warm. The rocks, the heat on the rocks warms the place up. You don't need heating, especially in the afternoon with the sun coming through there, because we get all day sun.
It's a good thing really, because mains electricity has never reached the wee granite house. A Pelton wheel, a form of hydro turbine, generates power.
And it's assisted with a couple of solar panels. And then from there, we go into the other rooms in here.
This looks pretty high-tech to me.
Yeah, Maiden One's an engineer. He's very, very clever. And that little light up there just coming off and on, that's dumping power. When it dumps power, that means we've the regulators and the batteries are full, so it'll dump the extra power, and we run it over to a hot water cylinder that's got a 12-volt element in it. And then that goes into outside showers, spa bath.
Your stove, what does that run on?
Gas.
Do you have a fridge?
Oh, yeah, but the power won't keep up with the Pelton wheel, because these new fridges have got elements in them. Automatic defrosting. And when I bought it, I didn't realise that sort of thing. So because it's automatically defrosting all the time, therefore it's got a heater, therefore it uses a lot of power. It's unnecessary, really. And we couldn't keep up with the loss of power for the system we were running. Wonder where it was all going. So I went over to Whitianga to, the warehouse, and I just bought a freezer, which just runs and turns off. Once the freezer's cold, it doesn't use much power at all. Just put some ice bottles in there and just put them in there. Two ice bottles in the fridge, lasts 24 hours, and your fridge works better than if it was plugged into power.
goodness.
You can do it at your place. You just have a freezer. You don't need to pay for a fridge. You try it.
Lindsay says he's one of just a dozen or so permanent residents living on his side of the peninsula, north of the beachside community of Ōtautu. But he says he doesn't have time to be lonely. Lindsay's an artist. He paints mainly in oils. He organises exhibitions and he's a poet. Lindsay also has an impressive collection of New Zealand pottery, housed in the shed originally used for processing the granite.
Yeah, well, I've been involved in the art for so many years and I know a lot of artists and potters. Like many.
The teapots and coffee cups that you have here, they date from, do you know the earliest one that you have here?
No, early 60s, 50s possibly. Mm. Just New Zealand potters.
Some pretty well-known ones, though.
Oh, yes. Very well-known. You know, it's a time, it's a story, you know, of people and potting and all that sort of thing. It's good. You know, like Merrick Smizek and Barry Brickle and Pam Ransell, Jenny Shearer, Helen Mason. You know, all the guys. So I've started another research thing. And I've got folders and folders of all the people in that. There's more to come, but there's no rush.
What's happened to the pottery scene in New Zealand?
Oh, it's coming back big time. Huge.
Because it kind of had a wave in the, 60s and 70s?
Well, earlier than that. Helen Mason started the Potters Magazine in 1958. And then, of course, the imports killed it. But now it's coming back.
Yeah, and I guess for you, it's just so distinctive. You can look up at those shelves and shelves full of teapots and cups and identify artist after artist just by the look.
Oh, I know. I know pretty much most of them, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And where they've come from and their era. And I've got boxes of unidentified marks. And every now and again they come up and I thought, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I just slowly getting, and I've just got miles of casseroles up there, and that only happened because I ended up with, you know, some real nice ones, and Wolf Wright and Janet Wright and Barry and Merrick Smizek and Glenn Castle and Andrew van der Putten and all that. And I thought, oh, yeah, so next thing you know, I'm adding to casseroles, but it's got to stop.
When you drive up here, you drive through arches of Whutukawas. There's Whutukawas on one side of the road and on the other, and you sort of drive under a canopy. And are they clinging on to granite?
Yes, all of this lot here are. Yeah, Whutukawa will grow anywhere. And in the early days, if you go on old photographs and paintings and things that were done around the place, you'll see there's not many Whutukawas because they used to cut them down and take them out for elbows and bits and pieces for shipbuilding.
You get the mail delivered here? You don't have to go into a post office box?
No, once a week we get the mail. Been like that for over 100 years.
Can you ask the mailman to bring you anything else?
Yes, you can ring up and they go around Coromandel or whatever, or Colville, or the chemist, or anything that you need or you might need. And it'll just come up for a small fee. And I can only recall the mail not turning up on a Wednesday once, because the mailman forgot it was Wednesday. So it's once in 100 years, not too bad.
And has there been any memorable storms here?
Oh, yes. But it doesn't have to be a big storm. The side of the hill up around the corner a bit further came down. The road was closed for over a month or something. Massive. The whole side of the hill came away. So the people living at Port Jackson couldn't get out at all until they opened it. That was a long time. So people were bringing them food and walking across the slip and giving them food if they needed it. If they had to go out, they had to walk over there and get into another vehicle and go out. Yeah. Because it's a one-way road. You can't go right round. It's quite handy if there's any riffraff up here, because there's only one way off this peninsula and it's past the police station in Coromandel. It doesn't matter where you go, you still got to go past the cop shop and over the bridge. And someone was up here doing some naughty stuff, stealing stock or something many, many years ago, and one of the farmers just got his tractor and we parked in one of the Fords and just left it there. There's no way of getting out.
Lindsay Garmson of Paratu Bay in the northern Coromandel. He's hoping to get a few dollars together to restore and preserve one of the granite wharves. We'll put some photos on our webpage.
Hi, I'm Dana Rowe. I'm a dairy farming trainee and you're listening to Country Life on RNZ National. Farming life, you beauty.
The Kiwi Spirit Distillery and Tasting Bar at Mutupipi lies between Takaka and Pohara in Golden Bay. It was established by local entrepreneur and veteran distiller Terry Knight. Terry makes an award-winning whiskey as well as artisanal gin, vodka and liqueurs. But Cosmo Kentish Barnes is there to find out about the exotic plants he's growing on a 10-hectare block of land behind the distillery.
You're actually in a big glass house, and we've filled it up with Weber Blue Agave Tequiliana plants. The plants you're looking at are, oh, I'd say 2 to 3 years old. We've done most of these through cuttings, what they call pups that come out of our original plants, and we've also done some tissue culture, which has been reasonably successful. And now we're actually sufficient in our own plants from our own pups that are coming up beside them, and once they're 2 or 3 years old, they start to throw out a little liter pup each, and so, you know, you can get 4 or 5 pups out of a plant.
How many young plants have you got in here?
Just over 6,000 plants in here, which we're now, the next phase of these ones is we're planting them out on the hillside, and that'll be turned into a wild plantation. And we have got them in a tunnel house where we've been growing them, but that was more or less to guarantee we could get a harvest and there was no complications. Our first small plantation I put in got heavily frosted one day, and then the cows broke the fence and came through and tromped it. So we thought, I'll put up a good tunnel house, and have now filled that with tequila plants.
Mm. Now these plants around us are about 30 centimetres high, and I can already see the sharp looking prickles that are developing on the leaves.
Yeah, they turn out to be about 2 inches long, 50 mils long when they are mature, and they're like a piece of steel. In the old days, the Aztecs would actually peel those off and take them down and have a needle and thread. And that's what they used to use for their for all their sewing and things like that. It was virtually an already threaded needle. And also the fibre is an amazingly strong fibre. I've had it in a compost heap for about 3 years, and it's refusing to break down.
You mentioned the Aztecs just before. This plant, this succulent, originates from the Americas, doesn't it?
Technically South America area. It's a specific tequila plant. There's 152 varieties of agave, and this is the Weber Blue Agave Tequiliana, which makes tequila. If you want to make mezcal, you make it from the Agave Solania or the Americana. And there's another third one as well, which are validly good, a good drink as well, but tequila has a somewhat more of an edge to it, I feel.
Is there anyone else in New Zealand who is growing this sort of agave plant to make spirits?
No. This is the only plant stock and plantation in New Zealand. There is some plants grown in Africa where they grow them for keeping the lions out, actually. The Spanish used to took this plants back to Africa and use them for lion protection around their herds. In Australia, there's a few growing there that they say they're growing them for fuel, for sugar fuel, to burn in the sugar kilns. That will probably evolve into a tequila being made one day. But we seem to have lucked out here where we've, even though we're growing at sea level, whereas in Mexico it's growing on high plateaus, we've been making a rather exceptional tequila that's been winning rather good awards, which is kind of exciting.
How did you get the first plants? Did you have to import them from Mexico?
Friends brought them in from a private collection in France. There's an absolute world ban on trading in the plants. It's part of what's called the CITES agreement. And they included seeds in that about 10 years ago, but we'd luckily had our seeds here by this point. And so we now have really the only plant stock in New Zealand of these plants. And in fact, it's incredibly limited around the world.
Do you have any problems with diseases or bugs?
We've had a few little problems. I mean, scale was one of our problems that we had some issues with. They didn't really kill the plant, but what they were doing was they just restricted it. But we thought about spraying, but there's so few of them. What we do now is we just take it out of here, and therefore we don't have to spray the whole crop. The other one that was interesting to us was the crickets. They tended to climb up it and start to nibble on the leaves. But I solved that by cutting the water off completely and drying the place out, and it wasn't such a beautiful environment for them anymore. So that kind of was a rather easy solution for crickets. Mm. I should take you up to what I call Little Mexico and show you the big plants.
Now we are walking across a paddock towards the rather gorgeous hills, which are covered at the bottom with native bush, and further up it's quite rocky.
Oh, have a look in here. There we go. So there it is, Cosmo. Little Mexico. 36 degrees.
36 degrees, lovely and warm. How big is this shade house?
The shade house itself is 2,500 square metres. We've laid the tequila plants out in rows, and those prickles, again, as you can see, just trying to work with them or anything like that, they get you. And just have a feel of that. That's like a bit of steel.
Ow!
See?
Crikey, that's sharp. You would not want to fall back on those.
No. Safety first is our whole policy in here, and anyone that I have helping me in here, which will come through and help me weed or something like that, they get a fairly clear instruction, and they barely get through a day without at least one prick. But they're not poison. They don't break off in you. It's just they'll go in you and they throb.
It looks rather like a desert in here. The earth is an orangey brown, and I guess they don't need much water.
No, well, we don't fertilise them. We give them a dripper of water about once a month for 12 hours, and that's all the water they get. I actually scraped the top metre of soil off of here because the soil was too rich for them. So I took a whole metre of topsoil off to get them down into some really, you know, more barren ground. They need to stress a wee bit, and if they can stress a wee bit, they'll produce higher starches, hence higher sugars, and that's basically the rule. We're trying to get them really, you know, pushing to grow and working to grow, and that just gives a much stronger juice that comes out for me.
Mm. The plants in here have leaves which are all about, a metre, just about a metre long. How long does it take for them to get this big?
They're an eight-year cycle, so what we're doing here, Cosmo, is we do rotational harvest on them. These plants on this side will be the first ones to harvest, then we'll move to the other side over there and we'll just quietly go through, and in the middle of that I've got some up the hill that we'll pull out as well.
So you're using these ones here to make your tequila?
Yep, that's what we're doing, and we call it tequila because we're not allowed to call it tequila.
Why aren't you allowed to call it tequila?
It's just rules very similar to champagne. And the champagne laws are the same, that you cannot make a name that even sounds like champagne. You must have a clear name. So I thought, well, tequila is our native language. So it's not making a word up. It's actually calling it a New Zealand tequila. And also the true definition is 100% blue agave.
Yes.
Is spirit is the actual legal term for it. Do watch your ankle just so you're within an inch of getting jabbed. But no, they're a very interesting plant to be growing, and I feel very honoured that I'm growing them.
How do you do the harvesting of these plants for making the tequila tequila?
Very carefully. Very carefully. I actually use a small excavator to dig them out, roots and all, and when they're tipped upside down, you'll find another three or four pups in the roots underneath. Mm. In Mexico, they tend to slice them off and cut them out by hand. But to be honest, we're not expert enough to do that. We would rather have a little digger pluck them out. We can take them outside, cut the leaves off, and then we basically, all the leaves will come off, and we end up with a heart in the middle, which could weigh anywhere between 20 and 40 kilos. It'll be about 600 long, maybe 300 wide, and we then cook that for 3 days. And after I cook it, so we've shaved all the leaves off, you've got a thing that looks like a pineapple, then you put that into an oven, which I'll show you too. I've just got the new oven, which is just on nearly 5.5 meters long, and we steam cook them for 3 days. And there's some temperature things you have to hit with that, but we're basically steam cooking them for 3 days. We take them out of the steam cooker, and we then put them, my old version was in the garden mulcher, but I'm building a bit more of a mulching machine for them. But I used a garden mulcher and a ringer washing machine, to be honest, Cosmo, for the last brew.
Good old Kiwi ingenuity.
Well, the ringer washing machine was the perfect toy for the job, and I put through 1,000 litres. And, well, I made 1,000 litres, so there was more like about 4,000 or 5,000 litres of mash went through to get that. But when you're dealing with it at this stage, it then sends your whole body numb. So when you're on the wringer washing machine, you'll be putting it through, and your whole face goes numb. You can't blink, you can't move your lips, and it's, I guess it's a health and safety thing. I should think about it. But they're fascinating to work, and it was such a learning process to even learn the process of producing tequila, because there's nobody here in New Zealand can tell you. And if I went to Mexico and started research, and I'd come back with broken legs. They don't really want, you know, a lot of people growing it outside Mexico, because it's a national drink.
Are people in Mexico aware of what you're doing here?
I had some pretty serious blogging attacks. But since then, I'm now actually working with the Mexican government representative who's in charge of preservation of the tequila plants. Hence, they've got a lot of issues there with the tissue culture being overdone, and they're not having the strike rates. They've had a massive demand for tequila, which has gone up roughly 196% in the last 3 or 4 years. So the demand for tequila is higher. The plants they're harvesting have been getting younger and younger, and now what we're growing is a kind of a unique backup in a way, because the genus of our seed stock was taken out of Mexico in the 1800s. So they're very interested in what I'm doing here, because this now will refresh their own drink stocks. And I had a visit from a Mexican soil scientist that's working with them, and I've given him some of my seeds to take back. And they're very happy that we're here doing this, and they see it very much as a sort of a satellite little protected enclave of their plants.
Terry's new oven is plonked in the yard near a large storage facility where pallets stacked high with boxes of spirits are ready to be dispatched.
When I harvest my next tequila plants, this is the oven I'll be using. So it's a 5.5 metre, 1200 across tube. That's actually a steam oven.
Solid.
And she's a beast. And my little oven was only 2 metres long, so this is somewhat of a step up in every way. And we'll cook the tequila hearts in here, or the pine as they're called, and that will then soften those plants that we can then process them and turn the starches into sugar.
How many hearts will you be able to fit in this barrel?
If you think of each heart as being about the size of a small sheep, we'll get 50. You could cook a lot in here.
And will that produce a lot of pulp?
Yeah, it'll be a very sort of sweetened, sugary pulp that we have to break it down. Then we have to put it into water and agitate it around to get the fibres to come to the top to get them out, because we can't put it through the still with the fibres in it. I've done that, and it took me nearly 2 weeks to strip the entire still down and clean out the fibre from every orifice that was in the still. And it was rather a big learning curve, that one. So I ended up making a baffle to stop the fibres rising up through the system. In fact, years later, about 3 years later, we were still finding bits of fibre coming through, right through to the condenser area of the still. Fascinating that it could even get that far.
How many years have you been fine-tuning the art of making tequila? When did you first get into it?
It was somewhat of an accident, really, Cosmos. I was a lonely alcoholic living deep in the forest, and I had no friends. So I wanted to make alcohol so friends would visit, and they did, in mass. So I then got commercial and started making honey wine, and we sold that, and that took time, and I got bored, and I started making whiskey. That takes 8 years, so I started getting into other drinks and making liqueurs. And then my friend turned up with the tequila seeds that he'd got from this collection in France, and it was one of those private cactus collections over there. Yes. And we started playing with the idea of sprouting them, getting them going, and they had to be cracked like a gorse seed at 40 degrees in an oven before they'd even germinate. So there was a little bit in it, and from that, 20 years plus ago, 25 years ago, I'm on my second plantation of tequila now, and starting to look like an ongoing process for us. Come on, I'll show you the stills anyway. We're making gin today, and it's a gin that we call Greenstone Gin.
Oh, I can smell the gin.
Yeah.
It smells good.
So you've got young Sue here. She basically batches up a lot of the start, the mixes for us, measures it, gets it ready, and then she gives it to me, and I usually throw it in the still. But Sue runs the stills with me here, and we're now just monitoring and looking. We're getting a pretty good return out of here. Oh my God, that one's nearly full. Shit, that's on a big production today, Jared, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Right at the...
All we got to do is we'll hook it up to that and we'll pump it into this one here.
What else needs to be done before it comes out as delicious gin?
There's some dancing around the still that we do and a little animal sacrifice, but once we've got that out of the way, we get it down to its desired alcohol content, and at that point we can taste test. We then cross-check it with the previous batch we made to see it tastes the same. On occasions, we've batched whole batches back together with each other to get a consistency. And that comes because you might have had fresh juniper berries versus very dried Brent juniper berries, or you might have had fresh lemon verbena versus dried verbena.
Yes. Now, the rather ornate and beautiful stills, Arnold Holstein stills, are made of copper?
Yep, they're high-grade copper.
Why copper?
Copper creates a negative charged ion, whereas if we brewed this in a stainless steel still, it would be a harsher alcohol. You make a distillant or an alcohol through a stainless still, it actually tastes like burnt cabbage, versus the copper still has a more rounded feeling on your mouth. And it's all about the polarity of the charge of the elements in it. It strips out the shit alcohol using the still a lot easier, the copper a lot easier.
The liquid residue from the agave hearts is also distilled in this machine.
The mash would be maybe 8% alcohol when it goes in, possibly 10, and then it's brewed, and we get left with this sludge in the bottom, which we drain, and the rest of it drips out as a white liquid into our collection tanks, and that is technically just tequila at about 70 or 80%. So we then have to take that tequila and break it down to 40% with water, and from there we can then start to consider bottling it. But we like to give it a month or two just to sit, because there is a certain amount of bottle shock, or still shock in this case.
Do you see your Tekiwi tequila as the kind of flagship of this business?
It's a mix between my Waitui whiskey and my tequila. That would be really the flagships. Gins, of course, are coming up as I'll call them a fashion, but even that fashion will wear out eventually. Mm-hmm. And, the fashion in New Zealand was once drinking bourbon. Mm-hmm. What's happened really is that a lot of high-end marketing guys have got into gin because they can make a label, they can market, and they can come to someone like me and have us make it easily for them, quickly as well. Whereas a whiskey or a tequila, they're an 8-year process.
Now, your tequila is top shelf. It's quite expensive, isn't it?
It's bringing in the true connoisseurs, is what I'll say. When we say it's $1,000 a bottle, even that is pretty average for a high-end tequila in the States. It's rated by fourth and fifth generation tequila growers and producers as one of the best tequilas they've ever drunk. And we are selling the tequila. I mean, it's not... we had one week last month, we sold 5 bottles in a week, whereas I'm only trying to sell 300 bottles a year till we come on to full production, which will be 15,000 bottles a year.
When's your next batch due to be made?
The next real harvest, the real serious harvest, will be 2.5 years away. Maybe 3. That'll be 3 months of just work and probably a lot of pain from working with the tequila plants.
And you've got plans to extend your agave growing operation here, haven't you?
We're looking at another 10-acre block that we want to put it on and fill that up. And it's been a hell of a learning curve, Cosmo. You know, I mean, we've had a lot of nights testing, which has been dangerous for us. And I've learnt to mix a good margarita finally. You know, sold my skin, sold a beautiful piece of land and put all the money in, and here we are now, and we're getting there, you know.
Terry Knight there from the Kiwi Spirit Distillery and Agave Tequilana Plantation at Motupipi in Golden Bay. And next week, Cosmo's back in the Nelson region with a couple who've gone bush. in a big way. They forage and hunt for food with just canvas between them and the night sky.
Well, that's it for this week. Now, our webpage has photos and more stories, and remember, you can subscribe to our podcast there too. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at RNZ Country, and we do like to hear your feedback, so email us at country@rnz.co.nz. Bye now.
Bye.